As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome back to another episode of the Athletic Hockey Show. I'm Ian Menace alongside Sean McAdoo. Ahead on this episode, we'll look back at Tuukka Rask's mental gap that fortunately did not come back to bite the Boston Bruins. We'll heat up a big old bag of popcorn, check in on the soap opera that is the Columbus Blue Jackets these days. Ron Hextall takes over in Pittsburgh, which has us thinking about how many times a hated player has taken over an arch rival's franchise. Jesse Granger drops by for Granger Things. We chat about the over-unders in the National Hockey League in the first month of the season. We'll get into the mailbag. And this week in hockey history, we look back at Theo Fleury's unbelievable night for the Calgary Flames. As we kick off this show, Sean, I got to tell you, we got some big shoes to fill here because LeBrun and Burnside, in this space on Wednesday, they had Jason Spezza on the show. We do want to encourage our listeners, check out, if you did not hear, Burnside and LeBrun in conversation with one of my all-time favorite guys to cover in Jason Spezza. Check it out. It was Wednesday's podcast. I got to ask you, too, Ottawa fans are super conflicted on Jason Spezza, right? Like, he is, I think at this stage of the game, people look back, realize how good we had it in Ottawa with Jason Spezza. Like, how do Leaf fans look at Jason Spezza as being part of that team?
Yeah, it's, they're loving it right now because he's playing fantastic. He was good last year, given the expectations, given the role that he was playing. But the numbers he's putting up this year so far have been excellent. And I mean, as far as the Senators connection, I feel like he is a guy that doesn't really associate with the rivalry. Like, he did arrive in Ottawa around that time that the Battle of Ontario was raging in the playoffs, but because of Jacques Martin and because of he was a younger guy, he didn't really have big roles. So I don't think there's too many Leaf fans that hold out any bitterness towards him. He was certainly part of those teams after the lockout where there was a few years there where every time the Senators played the Leafs in the regular season, the Senators would win 8-0, and Jason Spezza and that top line would be on the ice for 6 of the goals. But I think we can forgive and forget that because then Leaf fans didn't like those Leaf teams either, so they were okay with it.
Yeah, I want to say Jason Spezza maybe played in 2 playoff games against the Leafs, maybe in 04, but that might be it. Like, you're right, he wasn't really a huge factor back in the day. But Spezza in the Leafs, Sean, I think a lot of us were looking at the game Wednesday night, circling it, thinking, here we go. A couple of games, Montreal-Toronto, battle of the heavyweights in the North Division. The Leafs win this one. Here's my question for you. And by the way, congratulations to you with what you were doing there with your little jinx with the Habs.
It worked perfectly. Put the Habs ahead of the Leafs in the power rankings. And
Exactly. It played out exactly like you said. Should there be legitimate concern if you're a Montreal Canadiens fan? They play Ottawa last week. They didn't look great. They split. They lose to Toronto. Is there a little bit of a, you know, are we seeing a little bit of vulnerability in a team that we thought was so dominant 10 days ago?
I mean, I don't think there should be any panic. I think that if your conclusion a week ago was that this was a team that was going to play 750 hockey for the whole season, then yeah, maybe you're concerned about the fact that they're losing to teams that you think they should beat, because if you're going to play at that level, you should be beating just about everybody. And I mean, I don't think realistically that's what we thought this Montreal team was going to be. I don't think that's realistically what we should think this Toronto team is going to be. And they're going to go through this at some point. I already saw somebody say that, you know, they play the Habs again on Saturday night. And then they play Ottawa three in a row. I mean, we could all see the big win over the Habs on Saturday coming, followed by the letdown against Ottawa. That stuff's going to happen over the course of a season, even a short one like this. So, I mean, I didn't see anything from Montreal watching that game last night where I thought, you know what, these guys are a mirage. These guys have been exposed. The Leafs are showing us the blueprint of how to beat them. I saw two pretty evenly matched teams. I think you could make a case that Montreal was the better team for the first period, and maybe both of the first two periods. And then Toronto being Toronto, they do have the ability to flip a switch and generate some quick offense. And that's what happened in the third period last night. Wasn't the usual suspects doing it, but you know, you're going to lose some games over the course of a year. And, you know, patience isn't really a Montreal market thing. But you got to have a little bit of patience here. I mean, you knew you were going to lose two out of three at some point in the season.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up that word patience, and that's not really a thing in any Canadian market. And you know, you got to walk me through this here. Okay, the Maple Leafs are first overall in the standings. They've lost two games in regulation time, and yet nobody seems happy with the way they're playing. Like, what's going on here? Is this like, I'm having a hard time out of the market, not quite following them. Like, why are Leafs fans so upset that their team is in first place overall? What am I missing here?
I don't know that they're upset. There's two things going on here. First of all, when you look at it, and if you're the sort of fan who looks at some of the underlying numbers, they suggest that this Leafs team has been good, but not amazing. James Myrtle had a really good breakdown on The Athletic where he went through some of the numbers. And basically what's happening with this Leafs team is they are completely deadly on the power play. You cannot take penalties against this team because they're hitting 40% on the power play. But you know that is not going to continue. Even as much talent as they have, as ridiculous as they can be, especially when they load up one unit, you're not going to be 40% all year. So you know that's going to come down. You tend to look at 5-on-5, and 5-on-5, the Leafs have been fine. They haven't been great, and they haven't been a team that's putting up the sort of numbers that would make you think that, yeah, this is going to be a first place overall team. So that's part of it. The fans who look at that stuff are sort of seeing a few warnings on the dashboard that the record might be a little bit misleading. The bigger thing is that the Maple Leafs are this year the classic team where it does not matter what they do in the regular season. They could have gone 56-0. They can finish first overall. They can finish first in the division. It's not going to matter until they get to the playoffs. Very similar to Tampa would have been the same thing last year, right? You were sitting there going, they got to do it in the playoffs. If the Leafs finish first in the division and then lose in the first round, this season is a disaster and there will be consequences and there will be probably some major moves made. And if they finish fourth, but they win a couple of rounds, great. That's the progress you want to see. This team is all about what they do in the playoffs and what they don't do in the playoffs and what they can avoid the sort of meltdowns we've seen in the past. So I think even the Leaf fans who might tend to be more on the optimistic side and more on the plan the parade side of that Leaf spectrum, they're not getting too excited right now because none of this matters if they don't win at least a round in the playoffs and probably two.
So let me paint a scenario for you. Let's say Toronto comes out of the North Division, and we know that the way that they're going to do this this year, Sean, is that there's a potential you could play anybody in that conference final and then into the Stanley Cup. Yes or no, do you take Toronto-Boston Stanley Cup? Does that excite you? Does that scare you to death? What does that do for you as a Leaf fan? Toronto, Boston,
yeah.
Stanley Cup final.
The answer is yes to all of your questions. That that would scare me to death, and I would be more than happy if somebody else could take care of the Boston Bruins for the Leafs along the way. But at the same time, I mean, you know what? When you've got that team that you just can't beat, sometimes you just got, the only way out is through. You got to beat that team to put an end to it. I mean, you know, you look at the Senators being an example, could never beat that Leafs team. Wouldn't you have wanted in one more crack? Wouldn't you have wanted to be able to say, you know, it always felt like, especially in like the 2002, 2004 teams, where you're like, if this is the year they beat the Leafs, there's no stopping them. They will get over that hurdle and they'll get past it. And we've seen examples in the NHL, in other sports, where it's like you gotta slay the dragon, you gotta get past them. But man, going into the Stanley Cup final, that would be rough. Because I'll tell you, if the Leafs make the Stanley Cup final, you want to talk about optimism, you want to talk about happy Leaf fans. We will be unbearable going into that. But then to go up against Boston and hockey gods forbid, if it all happened again and there was another collapse, that would be the one thing. That would just, if you're a fan of another team, that's what you're hoping for, because there's no funnier outcome than the Leafs finally making the Stanley Cup final and then blowing a 4-1 lead against the Boston Bruins in Game 7 again, and everybody makes fun of them for the rest of eternity.
Yeah. Hey, listen, speaking of the Bruins, their netminder Tuukka Rask made the rounds on Wednesday, Sean, with a bizarre sequence in their game against the Rangers. So in case our listeners didn't catch that game or haven't seen the highlight, it's the final minute of the game in regulation time, third period. Tuukka Rask leaves his net. And you often see this in the end of a game when a team is trailing by a goal or two. They pull the goalie. He leaves. They put the extra attacker on. The only problem was the game was tied. Tuukka Rask either just didn't look at the scoreboard or didn't know what was going on. He tried to make some jokes in this post game about it, but he left. And luckily, it didn't come back to bite the Boston Bruins, because imagine if the Rangers had gained possession, put the puck in the empty net, we would be talking about this in a much different way. But it got me thinking, Sean, because I think when you think of other sports, you can automatically think of these, and we'll call them brain cramp moments, where the athlete, for whatever reason, just doesn't think, right? Like I think of J.R. Smith in basketball. Remember a couple of years ago with LeBron with the meme, like, what are you doing? I can't believe you just did that. Or Chris Webber calling the timeout. Jim Marshall, there's a great clip of the old Vikings player, picks up a fumble, runs the wrong way. Larry Walker in baseball makes an out, I think in right field at Dodger Stadium, hands the ball to a kid. And meanwhile, the game's still going on because there's only two out. So I guess my question is, like Tuukka Rask yesterday, like that's an ultimate brain cramp. What are we talking about here? Let's try to put this in context in terms of other brain cramps in hockey history, because I'm having a hard time thinking of some right off the top of my head.
Yeah, so there are a few. Let me give you a few, and you can tell me if these fall into the brain cramp category or if they're more just kind of everyday mistakes. I'll start with the recent one. Brad Marchand whiffing on the shootout. Just leaving the puck at center ice. I mean, we've seen guys go in and make bad moves, have pucks hop over sticks, but to actually line up and just, you know, nudge the puck half an inch to negate your attempt, I would put that there. One that jumps to mind, and it felt a little bit more serious at the time, although it didn't ultimately turn out too badly. But you remember Keith Ballard swinging his stick in frustration
and
cranking his own goaltender. Yeah. Thomas Vokoun in the head. It just, you know, one of those where it's like, I mean, how does that even happen? If there's a brain cramp Hall of Fame, I think Patrick Waugh might be in it, because I've got two Patrick Waugh ones. One is the famous Statue of Liberty goal. Where he thinks he has the puck in his hand and he goes to Hot Dog and the puck is sitting right there and Brendan Shanahan pokes it in, which was a crucial goal in that playoff series. I mean, that helped turn a series around. The other one with Patrick Waugh, which was nowhere near as serious, but makes me laugh every time, is the time that he just took the puck and stick handled out the center ice and deked around Wayne Gretzky, which you can't do. It's an automatic penalty to go across center ice. Maybe he didn't know that was a penalty, but the fact that he was even just like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to deke out Wayne Gretzky here. It's almost like, Patrick, do you remember that you were a goaltender? But my all-time favorite And I feel no guilt in having a laugh at this guy's expense, because this guy's getting way too much positivity these days. We're all pumping his tires. We did it, I think, on last week's show, talked about how great this guy is. Mark Bergevin in the 2000 playoffs.
Yeah.
Blues against Sharks. He's playing defense for the St. Louis Blues, and there is a rebound. A puck comes up in the air, and Mark Bergevin catches the puck, which you're not allowed to do, throws the puck, which you're also not allowed to do, but throws it directly into his own net. And it's just one of those things. If you've never seen it, look it up on YouTube. 2000 Blues Sharks, Mark Bergevin. It's one of the funniest things you'll ever see, because nobody knows what just happened. Like, it's literally there. The play is going on. Something, there's a shot, and suddenly the puck is in the net, and nobody even knows it's there. The announcers don't know. The goalie doesn't know. The referee takes a while to figure out that the puck is in there, and then nobody can figure out how it got in. And the only two people who know are Mark Bergevin, because he's the guy who threw it into the net. And if you watch the replay, Chris Pronger sees the whole thing unfold. And he has the funniest reaction, because he doesn't stick around. He doesn't comfort anyone. He doesn't say anything to the goalie. He doesn't say anything to Bergevin. He just leaves. He just, like, total disgust. Like, I'm a head out. And he just heads to the bench and says nothing to anybody. It's one of the funniest plays and bloopers that I've ever seen. And that would be number one on my brain cramp list, because, dude, we've seen guys have own goals that are accidents or sloppy plays, but to grab a puck and throw it directly into your own net in a playoff game, I think that's an all-timer.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, those are great. Yeah. Those are perfect examples of, again, because I don't know that hockey necessarily, maybe the pace of the game, it doesn't lend itself to mental mistakes as much as the other sports, right? Like baseball, you can think of base running blunders or, right? Like Lonnie Smith getting tricked by, I think it was like a young Chuck Knobloch in the World Series. Like the other sports, like there's like a pace to it that lends itself to mental mistakes, and hockey doesn't. So that's great. Would you put Marty McSorley using an illegal stick? Is that a brain cramp or not?
I don't think that one is, because especially back then, everybody did that. Everybody was using illegal sticks all the time. And it wasn't that, that you didn't use it. It was that nobody ever called you on it. So that was kind of the sort of thing where I know to this day, there's still Kings fans who are salty about that. Not because their guy got caught very obviously breaking a rule, but because Montreal actually used a rule that was in the rule book against them. So I don't know that I put that up there. I'm sure that's probably number one on the all-time list of plays that mistakes that guys would like a do-over on, because it was very avoidable. And a lot of players back then had the regular sticks, and then they had the legal sticks that they would break out in overtime or in the final minutes. And apparently Marty McSorley didn't even have that. They were just all, they were all illegal. But I don't know if that was so much a brain cramp as a guy just doing what everybody else was doing in that era and largely still do today.
So I want to talk about something we've mentioned on the podcast, Sean, a couple of weeks ago when the Penguins had their opening, the vacancy as general manager, and immediately Ron Hextall's name came up, and you said this would be an all-timer in terms of, imagine a guy, an all-time Philadelphia Flyer, is now running the Penguins. And sure enough, and Brian Burke was a nice added bonus here for the hockey world to get Berkey back in that type of platform. So, I mean, first of all, the double hiring there, Brian Burke and Ron Hextall, do the Pittsburgh Penguins suddenly become a very compelling, entertaining front office right now? Like that might be
absolutely
top of the list.
Right to the top of the power rankings. And I mean, that's it. Brian Burke on his own. I mean, like I've said this in a couple of different places. I don't know if this is going to work for Pittsburgh. I don't know if I'm a Penguins fan, if I'm excited that Brian Burke is the guy in charge. But just as a hockey fan, the NHL is so much more fun when Brian Burke is prominently involved in running a team somewhere. This guy is just one of the great characters in the game, the great just sound bites and everything. And the fact that he's back there, I thought he was doing fine in his media role. I was enjoying the work that he was doing with Sportsnet. But I want this guy doing press conferences after a playoff game. I want this guy breaking down moves and throwing those sound bites out there. And the fact that you put him with Ron Hextall is just put them on any team and it's going to be a great combo. Put them on a Pittsburgh Penguins team facing all the tough decisions and with all the big personalities and history and everything there. Merrill Lemieux is your owner. It's going to be great. I'm grabbing the popcorn and I'm ready to go because this is just as a fan who is neutral when it comes to the Penguins, this is going to be phenomenal entertainment.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing because Hextall goes to, look, we talked about Jason Spezza earlier, kind of flipping sides in the Battle of Ontario, but not really having that same feel of, you know, a rival switching sides. Ron Hextall going to Pittsburgh, to me, might be at the top of the list of a guy, you know, doing a switch. And it got me thinking, like, how many times have we ever seen this in hockey, Sean? And I thought, okay, well, right off the top of my head, Brian Trottier, who is an all-time Islander. I know he ended up with the Penguins, but, you know, you think of, he might be the best player in Islanders history. And he coaches the New York Rangers and then does it for like 50 some odd games. Doesn't even last a season, right? So like to me, that's the all-time kind of gold standard in hockey of a player involved in a heated rivalry that kind of did a switch at some point later on in his post-playing career. Do we put Ken Dryden going to kind of run the Maple Leafs? I don't know. Like,
yeah, it's,
it doesn't quite work, does it?
No, that one is probably up there among the biggest of like, okay, there's a rivalry between the teams and one guy's associated with the one team. But I don't think, and this was before my time, but I don't think there's that many Leaf fans that hated Ken Dryden. I mean, by the time Ken Dryden was in Montreal in the 70s, that Montreal team was so good. And that Leafs team most years was so bad that it was a rivalry in name only and in history. But this wasn't a case where you can't point to a single game and be like, oh man, as a Leafs fan, that time Ken Dryden stole that game. Boy, that drove me crazy because we were so close to beating Montreal. No, you weren't. You never were. Not in the 70s. Nobody was. So I don't feel like when Ken Dryden came on, it was sort of an oddity, but it wasn't like, oh man, this guy, we've all got these bad feelings. And there's not a lot of other examples. Like you see it with players sometimes, like there's more examples of that. Guy Lafleur going to the Nordiques would be an obvious one. But in the front office, there's really not. It does suggest that a lot of teams are looking at this stuff and can't get over some of this. And I think Trottier is the best one because Trottier, that Islanders-Rangers rivalry, that was when it was born, was during that dynasty. You know, as short of Denny Potvin, I'm not sure there's anybody that you could have brought into the Rangers organization that that they would have had the bad feelings about. And the fact that it didn't last very long, like you said, is sort of the cherry on top of it, because I can't imagine what it would have been like to be a Rangers fan and see this guy that not that long ago, this wasn't Ken Dryden where you're going back 30 years. This was, you know, in the last decade, we hated this guy and now he's behind our bench. That would be tough to get over.
So if you're Ron Hextall, and I guess to some extent Brian Burke, Sean, and you're sitting in those chairs in Pittsburgh, like you have to hit the ground running here. There's not like, okay, let's take kind of 6 months and assess the situation. Like to me, there's a touch of immediacy in Pittsburgh. Like, and that's what happens when you have Crosby and Malkin on your roster. Now, the question I want to ask is if you're sitting in Hextall and Burke's chairs, what do you do with Evgeny Malkin, Sean? This guy is going to be 35 years old in July. He's got another year left on his deal at $9.5 million. This is the first time, like even last year, you look at his numbers. He was 74 points in 55 games last year. This guy is a Hall of Famer. He's produced at a Hall of Famer's clip. This year, a little bit of a flat start, 6 points in 11 games. Like, what do you do? If you're the Pittsburgh Penguins, what do you do with Evgeny Malkin?
It's a great question because he has not been good this year. But like you said, he was very, very good last year. I think the first thing you do is you don't panic. You don't let yourself get pushed into a situation where you do something or even say something that is going to put this issue on the front burner. You've got time, not a lot of time, but you've got time left on this contract. You're not going to be able to move a guy like that during a season, even if you wanted to. In a hard cap league, it's very hard to make that big of a move. If anyone can do it, maybe it's Brian Burke because he loves those take those big swings on trades. But I can't see that. So what you do is you say, hey, this guy has been a great player for us for a long time. He was great last year. We believe he's going to get back to that level. And hey, by the way, we can't even talk extension with him until the offseason anyway. So it's a moot point. We're going to let him sort it out. We're going to get him back on track. And then you hope that he gets back on track and has the sort of season you expect him to have. If he doesn't, that's when things get tricky, because you go into the offseason and now he's and his agents are coming to you saying on July 1st or whatever the calendar equivalent to July 1st is going to be this year, you can sign an extension. Do they come to you and say, we want a deal? I would be hesitant if Genny Malkin has had a tough season to put pen to paper on a big, long extension on a guy who's going to be in his mid-30s on that first day. I would be willing to go into the season even and say, let's go into the last year of the deal and just see how it works out. You've built up a relationship with this player. Hopefully you've got some credibility on both sides. I don't think this should be something where going in the last year of a deal is some sort of awful distraction for the team. Maybe it is, but I don't want to get locked in on long-term deals to guys who are going to be into their late 30s, unless they're playing at a level that warrants that. And if Genny Malkin might be by the time that decision comes around. But if not, keep your options open. At that point, maybe in the offseason, maybe you do look at a trade, or maybe you do say, you know, this is a situation where next year, if we're not very good, maybe Malkin's a piece that we move during the season, later in the season, around a trade deadline sort of scenario. We can keep some salary and get prospects and assets back. Keep your options open would be my advice. Don't say or do anything that's going to get people thinking that you're leaning one way or another. And go into the offseason with an open mind, and don't let yourself get pressured into signing an extension just to get it out of the way that you're going to immediately or in not very long end up regretting.
You used the phrase earlier when we said that Brian Burke and Ron Hextall were taking over in Pittsburgh. Yeah, get your popcorn ready for them, because there's going to be entertainment. That's been the feeling in Columbus in the past week, Sean, where our Aaron Ports line has been a busy, busy man. Mm-hmm. The last week, when you consider in the span of about, I think, 72 or 96 hours, there was the replay controversy with the Canes. There was John Tortorella. Oh, by the way, we're going to just go ahead and bench Patrick Laine. And then, Mikko Koivu retires. Like those are the types of stories that each one on their own in a vacuum would be probably great for a week's worth of fodder, and yet it was back-to-back-to-back in Columbus. What is going on there? Why is every story in the NHL coming out of Columbus these days?
Doesn't it feel like, poor Columbus fans, for 20 years, they're the forgotten team that nobody mentions, nobody talks about, and you can just picture some poor Blue Jackets fan wishing to the hockey gods that, please let Columbus be the center of attention, and it's like a monkey paw situation where you be careful what you wish for. Some of this is just coincidence and bad luck. I mean, when having that call and the whole breakdown that went with that go against them, that could have been any team. But some of this is self-inflicted, and some of this is the John Tortorella factor. I mean, this is a guy who conflict has followed him. I think would be a polite way to say it throughout his career. We all know who this guy is at this point. He's not somebody who necessarily keeps his emotions to himself. He's not a guy who always chooses his words carefully, or maybe he does. And maybe this is all very intentional on his part, these controversies that he's always stirring up, whether it's the media or a player or whoever. Maybe it's very thought out, and he just feels like this is the best way to lead his club. But certainly when you look at Patrick Laine's situation, this is a case where a new player has come in. He's come in a trade for a guy that wanted to leave. And they're whether it's true or not, whatever people say, there's whenever a player says, I want out, people are always going to look at the coach and the management and say, was that a factor? You make the trade, a new guy comes in. A lot of us went, we got to see how this works out. And within 2 weeks, you already have another situation brewing where he's not just being disciplined, but being disciplined by being benched, which is the most public way that you can do it. There are ways that you can discipline players that we as fans or the media will never find out about. To choose to do it during a game in a public way where you know the questions are going to come. John Tortorella's a smart guy. This might all be very calculated, and this might be something where we look back and go, yeah, that was exactly the right move. I'm sure he's doing it because he thinks it's the right thing for the team. But man, there has got to be a point where if you're a Columbus fan now, you're kind of like, it would be nice to go a week without any headlines. It would be nice to go a week where we're just talking about wins and losses and not the latest John Tortorella soundbite or thing that he said, or and because that's what people are going to talk about. And John Tortorella can show up after the game and tell the media, don't ask questions about this, all that he wants. It is a story. And it's a story that people are going to wonder about and talk about, whether he likes it or not. And you just kind of sit there and go, all right, now what? What's going to be next with this team?
Yeah. Hey, listen, what's next for us is Jesse Granger. But before we get to Jesse Granger, I don't know if I've ever told you the story, Sean, at the time. Like, I had the wrath of John Tortorella in a scrum. And this would have been like, so John would have been coaching the Rangers at this point, you know, whatever, 7, 8 years ago. And I start asking him a question about the standings. So it's a scrum. And I start asking him a question about the standings. Like, John, when you look at the standings, and he's like, no. I'm like, okay, no, don't ask me about the standings. Don't ask me about the standings. And he gets really angry with me. And I'm like, oh, geez. Okay, I didn't realize this was like a trigger word for you, was standings, right?
Yeah.
So it's awkward. And, you know, I had to rephrase it and he short answered me. And the scrum ends and I walk away and he comes up behind me, puts his arm on me. He goes, sorry about that, man. I hate questions about the standings. And he walks away. And I'm like, imagine being a coach of the NHL and you're like, don't ask me about the standings. Yeah. Like, but it was the weirdest thing. And it was almost, you know, the Seinfeld episode where you got to order the soup in the right way. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, if you don't order the soup in the right way, that's how it was. It's like with Tortorella. That's like asking him a question. You have to phrase it just right. But in a weird way, I have a ton of respect for him because at least like he pulled me aside. He's like, sorry, like you triggered me there. But it was just the most random thing.
I know. I mean, I don't have a lot of time for the John Tortorella media act. And I understand, I'll put the disclaimer. I understand nobody cares. Nobody wants to hear this because I'm in the media and it's like, yeah, of course you guys don't want to get yelled at. But that just, you've never told me that story before. But I know every time he does one of these meltdowns, whether it's the short press conferences or it's the Brooksy or whatever it is, there's people who go, you know, he's not really like that. He's putting on an act. He's playing a character. Yeah, but you're still doing it. And there is a part of me that says, you know, if you're going to bark at a guy in front of all of his colleagues and then privately say, hey, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I'm not a big fan of this stuff. I think with John Tortorella, there is probably at this point, John Tortorella, the guy, and then John Tortorella, the character that he sort of plays with the media. And again, it might be calculated. It might be the sort of thing where he's thought this through. And I'm not saying that the guy's a jerk. I'm just saying he plays a jerk on TV an awful lot, and it gets old at some point.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, Sean, we'll move over to a little Granger things with our pal Jesse Granger joining us from Las Vegas. A reminder that to all of our betting related coverage here at The Athletic, brought to you by BetMGM, the exclusive betting partner with The Athletic. How is Jesse Granger on this Thursday?
I'm doing pretty good. That Super Bowl was a wild one, and the conversation we had last week was a good one to precede it.
Well, exactly. I mean, we talked about, Jesse, the prop bet of Tom Brady touchdowns versus Alexander Ovechkin points. And that one ended up being a pretty interesting, the way that that played out was pretty interesting with the way Ovechkin had the afternoon against the Flyers.
Right. And I, of course, I came on here and I said to everyone, he's only scored three or more points in 6% of his career games. And that, of course, means he's going to go off on Sunday. And he did. I think he had 3 points before the halfway point in the game. He ended up with 2 goals, 2 assists for 4 points. And everyone on Twitter let me know. But Brady almost came through, even despite Ovechkin's monster game. Brady throws 3 touchdowns in the first half. I honestly, after that, at halftime, I was feeling pretty good. I didn't bet that prop bet. But I think anyone who did was probably feeling good with those 3 touchdowns in the first half by Brady. But he didn't throw another one in the second half. So Ovechkin ended up winning that bet at a plus 200 underdog for those who bet it.
I just got to say, because we all said we were on the Brady side of that bet, and there was so much trash talk on Twitter when Ovechkin had the 4 points that I briefly found myself during the Super Bowl rooting for Tom Brady to throw 2 more touchdowns. And I will never forgive all of you for putting that thought in my head that I was rooting for Tom Brady to do even better in the Super Bowl than he was already doing.
See, betting does crazy things to people, doesn't it? It makes for strange bedfellows. You're right. I'm with you. I don't know if I could get around to cheering for Tom Brady. Before we get into a couple of lines, Jesse, with you, a quick question on the team that you cover as well for a regular basis, that being the Vegas Golden Knights, off to a terrific start. Who's the number one goalie there right now? Like, if they had a must-win game tonight, is it Robin Lehner or Marc-Andre Fleury?
That is a tough question to answer. Marc-Andre Fleury has been, I think pretty clearly the better goalie through, but they've only played 10 games. They've played 5 each, and they've split them 1-1 each game. And Marc-Andre Fleury's clearly been the better goalie this season. But at the same time, Peter DeBoer showed us last year during the playoffs and after they acquired Robin Lehner that maybe that's his style of goalie. I think Pete DeBoer, just the analytical style of hockey he likes to play, the possession style, he likes a blocking goalie who's maybe a little more consistent and not as Lehner may not have the highs that Fleury does, but he also may not have the lows. But yeah, so far this season, I think they'd have to go with Fleury just based on form. He has been spectacular. He's 5-0. He just finally allowed more than 2 goals in a game for the first time ever in their last game. So he's been awesome. But this team has 2 really good goalies, and I think this competition is probably going to be close throughout the season.
Let me throw something at both of you as well. As we're talking about Marc-Andre Fleury, Sean, let me start with you. We just talked about Ron Hextall, Brian Burke taking over in Pittsburgh. The goaltending's been pretty bad. Tristan Jarry, Casey DeSmith, the save percentage is like in the 800s. If you're Pittsburgh, Sean, do you kick the tires of bringing Marc-Andre Fleury back?
I think we all expected that to happen in the offseason, and for whatever reason, it didn't. Again, tough deal to make in the middle of a season with cap problems, but certainly when you look at how that situation has gone for both sides, as bad as the goaltending's been in Pittsburgh, as good as Marc-Andre Fleury has been after an off year last year, he looks like he's back to his old self. Boy, you talk about new management coming in. You want to make a move that's going to be popular. Bring Marc-Andre Fleury back to Pittsburgh. This is a guy who's, I can't think of too many guys who ever left the team and were still as beloved as he seems to be with those Penguin fans. It feels like there's a lot of different pieces falling into place to make this something that can happen. And when it comes to the salary, you can get creative. I'm sure there's a way to work it out.
Just to chime in, I think that conversation of kicking the tires on Marc-Andre Fleury has gone from, I think early in the offseason, if you would have called Kelly McCrimmon and said, hey, we're interested in Marc-Andre Fleury, it's like, okay, how do we get this deal done? Let's set this up. And now I think it's become, you know what, maybe call me back in a couple weeks, because if Robin Lehner, like, he struggled through 5 games, and I don't expect him to struggle for the entire season, but if that continues, I don't see how the Golden Knights could possibly justify trading a Hall of Fame goalie that's clearly the better goalie on the team right now when you're expecting to win a Stanley Cup. So I think that maybe the Golden Knights' eagerness to trade Fleury has cooled a little bit based on how the two goalies have played through 10 games.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just one other thing to throw out there, though. You look at Brian Burke's history as a GM. What's been his kryptonite? What's been the one thing every place that he's gone, not having the goalie? Famously in Vancouver, you look in Toronto, not being able to make that move for the goaltender. You got to think, if you're looking for a motivated buyer, man, the Penguins might be that right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's going to be a fascinating, and I mean, imagine Ron Hextall's first significant move is bringing a goalie in to save the Pittsburgh Penguins. I think it would be dripping with irony and intrigue. So it would be a lot of fun. So Jesse, every week when we get you on here for Granger Things, we love talking some of the betting lines going on in the National Hockey League as we're looking at trends. So let's start with a little over under here, and we'll start with the teams that are consistently maybe putting the puck in the net and or maybe allowing the goals, but are consistently going over in the games that they're playing in.
Right. That's the great thing about betting totals is it you're almost betting the feel for the game rather than which team is actually going to show up. And sometimes it can be more consistent to bet the totals than the sides. And so I went through and I looked at the top three teams that have gone over the total the most. And number one, the team we just have talked about quite a bit, Vegas Golden Knights. They have gone over in 8 of their 10 games so far, an 80% over hit percentage. And it's actually strange because we just talked about how good the goaltending has been, and they haven't allowed many goals this season, but the Golden Knights have been scoring enough to overcome that regardless. So obviously Mark Stone has been having a phenomenal year. He's got 15 points in 10 games. Max Pacioretty leads the team in goals, and this offense has been really scoring. They have 8 overs. When the total is usually 6 goals for this team, they're averaging 6.2 goals per game. So what that tells me is, yes, they've gone over the total 8 times, but maybe not a surefire over going forward. Despite that, it seems like they're just barely eking out those overs each time. Whereas you go down to the second team on this list, Washington Capitals, they've gone over 79% of their games, almost the same. They've gone over 9 in 9 of their 12 games, but there's games have had an average of 7.16 goals per game, which is the highest in the entire NHL. They've given up 43 goals and they've scored 43 goals. The Capitals are an offensive machine, and right now that blue line has been chipping in on offense, not so much in their own end. And they probably haven't gotten the goaltending that they expected to out of Ilya Samsonov to this point in the season. Again, it's early. I don't think we want to write the kid off, but he hasn't been as good as they probably hoped he would be when they let Holtby go. So they've been an over machine. And then finally, the last team on this list, the one that intrigued me the most, was the Los Angeles Kings. Because since I've been watching hockey, this has been a grind it team. Like when they won those Stanley Cups, I think they ranked 27th and 29th in offense those 2 years. This team has not scored goals or given up goals for a long, long time. And gone are those days. This is a younger, faster Kings team that is not nearly as buttoned up in its defensive end, and Jonathan Quick is not nearly as capable of bailing them out as he used to be. So there, the Kings games have gone over in 9 of their 14 games so far. It's been fun to watch. I've been catching a lot of their games just out here on the West Coast. So a team that maybe bettors aren't expecting to go over, and the totals have been 5.5 for these guys. So it's like, the market hasn't caught up. You're getting a better line than whereas like the Capitals and the Golden Knights, the total is going to be 6, maybe 6.5 every night. The Kings, you can get a 5.5 here and there just because I think it's their history of being a low scoring team and the fact that they're not good. So a lot of people don't bet the over on them. You look at the other side, which teams are going under the most. The number one team doesn't surprise anyone, the New York Islanders. That's Barry Trotz. That is this defensive system that doesn't allow goals. It helps when your goalie's playing as well as Varlamov is back there. He's already got 3 shutouts this season, leads the NHL. But again, he doesn't have a huge workload because that team plays so well structured defensively. I told you that the Capitals have 7.16 goals per game in their games. The New York Islanders have 4.73 goals per game, which is absolutely insane, but basically what you'd expect. And then the other two teams that have gone under the most are two teams that I think people would kind of expect, and that's Detroit Red Wings and the Anaheim Ducks. And both cases, it is teams that simply cannot put the puck in the net. The Red Wings maybe do surprise some people because they aren't giving up 6 goals a night like they were last year. They've played a little better defense. They've gotten a little better goaltending. Thomas Greiss, I think it's been 468 days. I've been following the guys in Detroit. They've been keeping the streak. No goalie other than Jonathan Bernier had won a game in Detroit in 468 days. He finally broke that streak, but they're still going under the total. 4 out of their 14 games, they've gone under the total. Same for the Ducks, 4 out of their 14 games. The Ducks, on the other hand, have a phenomenal goalie back there in Jod Gibson, who somehow has a .918 save percentage despite facing, I think, the 7th highest danger chances in the league. I mean, their defense isn't great, but their defensive numbers are decent because John Gibson's back there bailing them out. So Ducks, Red Wings, and Islanders, if you're going to bet the unders, Golden Knights, Capitals, and Los Angeles Kings, surprisingly, if you're going to bet the overs this year.
As we wrap up with you here, Jesse, I just want to go around the horn. And again, I don't know if at some point you're going to be able to wager on this, but Sean, maybe I'll start with you on this. What are the odds you think every team in the National Hockey League gets to the 56-game mark this season? If you had to put down some money or make you know, educated guess or a bet here, Sean. What do you think the chances are of all 31 teams getting to 56 regular season games?
After the last week, I think every team getting to 56 has moved into the underdog column. And I don't know exactly what those odds would look like, but I think they're trending more and more towards the fact that we all got to get used to looking at that points percentage column in the standings, because I do not at this point think that we're going to be able to make up all the games that we're going to need to make up, even with some time built in at the end of the season. I just don't see it. And as long as everyone's got a decent chunk of games and we're close enough, go to points percentage, work the playoffs that way, that's good enough. And I think we all got to start getting our heads around that now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And obviously, I think I might be a little biased just because the team I'm covering has dealt with a lot. Mm-hmm. They just... 2 days ago, they finally got Alex Pietrangelo off that COVID protocol list. That was their first day without anyone on there in a while. And that day, Tomáš Nosek gets pulled out of the game after two periods with a positive test. They are supposedly going on with the game tonight. I am going to be heading to morning skate when I get out of here with you guys. We'll see if that game continues. But you mentioned, Ian, like, will this be something you could bet on? It's been fun watching this sports betting landscape change as someone in Vegas who's kind of been around it for years. Now that it's going nationally and like in New Jersey and these places are legalizing it and it's becoming a more mainstream thing, we're seeing bets that used to be only available on offshore books that are now available in actual legitimate sports books like BetMGM. Like, for example, the Gatorade thing. We joke about in the Super Bowl, the color of the Gatorade. That used to be a bet you could only make in some offshore book. Who knows if you're getting paid after when you win that bet. Like, it's you're rolling the dice on it. Now, that was a widely available bet at pretty much any sports book you could find in the country. So, yes, I do think bets like that and kind of strange bets that aren't exactly having to do with specifically the games are going to become more and more available, and that's great news.
Well, listen, Jesse, as always, we appreciate the visits with you on Thursdays. Fingers crossed everything goes smoothly for the Golden Knights in the week ahead, and we'll get you again next week.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Jesse.
Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point-of-sale system you can trust, or is it a... real POS. You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Tell you what, Sean, I had the chuckle when Jesse says, you know, as long as I've been watching the Kings since 2012, like these younger guys that come in. For us, when you're watching, I think my earliest memories of the Kings, I'm thinking the purple and yellow jerseys.
Yep.
Luke Robitaille and Jimmy Carson. What did they have? Was it Goldust Twins or something? What was their nickname? Do you remember this?
I don't remember that one. I remember the bruised banana uniforms. And for me, you know, where I was in Toronto, seeing those uniforms, I can hear my parents telling me, go to bed. You're not allowed to stay up. It's 11:30. You can't watch the second Hockey Night in Canada game. The Oilers are already winning 6-0. It's halfway through the first period. Yeah. Go to bed. And then, yeah.
pick.
Yeah, that's I only think of that, and because you and I are, again, same age, the Rock'em Sock'em videos, and there's one where, like, was it Phil Sykes is fighting Wayne Gretzky?
Yes.
And he's with the Kings, right? Like, that's my earliest memory of the LA Kings.
I think for me, it's right up there. It's that. And then the other one, and this was another Rock'em Sock'em classic, the live chicken being thrown on the ice. Wearing a purple cape that gets tossed onto the ice, a live chicken, by the way. Like, we're not talking like a supermarket package of chicken. Like, somebody throws a live chicken onto the ice during a game, and the game goes on for like a minute.
Yeah, 45 seconds or
whistle
something,
it down. Yeah. These days, like, anything happens, they go, okay, let's all stop and get organized. There's a live chicken on the ice, and for so long, and they don't whistle it down. That was back in the days before the Gretzky trade. There was the miracle on Manchester, a chicken on the ice, and that was pretty much it as far as Kings highlights go.
Yeah, absolutely. When somebody threw the waffle on the ice, did the game stop?
I'm trying to remember if that happened during a stoppage, or if it happened during an actual game. And I don't remember that one. That's definitely up there as far as the dumbest items thrown on the ice.
Yeah.
This stupidly, it's the only league where you could say the phrase chicken and waffles, and instead of breakfast, people think about dumb things being thrown onto the ice during games.
Oh, exactly. All right. Hey, let's get to the mailbag here. A reminder, you can reach us at theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. That's theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. We also want to invite you. We'd love to hear your voice, your actual voice. We'd love to hear it. Drop us a voicemail. We got a answering machine set up, and you can leave us a voicemail, and we will answer your question gladly in this space. The voicemail number for you, it's 845-445-8459. 845-445-8459. We would love to hear from you. I got a couple of emails here for us to tackle, Sean. This one comes in from Matthew, who says, hey guys, do you think some point later this season we'll see some gamesmanship from teams with waiver claims? For example, let's say the Habs have Corey Perry. Do you think a team like Toronto would make a claim on him late in the year if the Habs try and put him through waivers to shuffle him back and forth to the taxi squad? That comes in from Matthew. So that would be, man, Corey Perry, Jason Spezza, Wayne Simmons. That'd be quite.
Yeah, that would be a fun one. In theory, yes, there should be some circumstances where you would see this. And obviously, everybody's tight against the cap. Everybody's trying to save that cap room so they can make moves at the deadline. So you're not going to see teams just going crazy on this. And I do think that even though this is supposed to be a cutthroat league and you're supposed to be doing everything you can to win, I think some teams are going to say, look, if we don't want to use a guy, let's not go and claim a guy and disrupt his life and make him move across a country or a continent in the middle of a pandemic just so we can play games. But I mean, you mentioned the Corey Perry example. Corey Perry's playing pretty well. If they try to sneak him back through, then yeah, some other team might want to grab him. We saw the Jason Spezza thing, which was interesting because Spezza basically said, when he was waived earlier this year, if you claim me, I will retire. And so, of course, nobody was going to do that. But that was before he was, the top 50 or 60 in scoring in the NHL. Maybe now somebody says, you know what, let's call his bluff and see what we can do. Or maybe let's claim a guy and then say, oh, did you really need that guy? Well, I'll flip him back to you for a sixth or seventh round pick. And, let's see how that goes. In theory, that should happen. In theory, we should also have offer sheets in this league. So we'll have to see if these GMs really want to play to win or not. But it's an interesting scenario, especially this year, given how much movement we've seen with teams with this new taxi squad element, having to pass guys through waivers as often as they do. And by the way, remember that day where everybody was going through waivers at the beginning of the season? That was 30 days ago. So we should expect pretty soon that waiver is going to expire. We're going to see probably a lot of action late this week. And maybe that'll be when we see exactly that sort of gamesmanship start to break out.
DJ Nightingale also has emailed us again to theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. DJ, thanks for the note. Writes in, hey guys, trying to figure something out. Why have the COVID outbreaks only been occurring in U.S. cities and affecting U.S. teams and not the Canadian cities? Is there anything Canada is doing differently or better than the United States. That's from DJ. And look, the one thing I think we want to be careful, like, we don't want to get on some sort of high horse here and make it seem like, oh, I can't believe what you're doing down there. But listen, there's obviously some differences. In fact, I had a good conversation with Anthony Duclair yesterday for something I'm hoping to put together for The Athletic next week. And one of the things Anthony told me, just as we were chatting to start the interview, he's like, everything is open here. He's like, everything is open in Florida. He's like, it's as if there's nothing going on. And you juxtapose that with, I mean, the city where you and I live, Sean, if for people who don't know, we live in Ottawa. And it is a ghost town right now. The only things that are open as we speak right now are grocery stores, and the schools have just kind of reopened. But that's it. It's a ghost town. And so I guess that there is an element of that that could be a factor. But it is remarkable to think that you look at the situation. The COVID has not affected the NHL in Canada yet, but we're not naive enough to think that it won't happen or couldn't happen in the next few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the number one answer to the question is good luck. There's been some good luck here that we haven't seen an outbreak in Canada yet, as far as the NHL. And as you say, there are reasons for that. The whole shutdown thing, the whole wear your mask, be considerate, is less of a political situation here than it is down south for a variety of reasons. But at the same time, you know, we've been slower on the vaccines, and the cold weather lasts longer here. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if in a month we might be saying, wow, isn't it crazy that all the outbreaks are in Canada and none of them are down in the U.S. divisions? It's the sort of thing where, you know, hey, great news that so far it hasn't been an issue. But I think the word you used was naive. You would have to be naive to think that's going to continue all season long. I'd be very surprised if it does.
All right. As we wrap up every show, we do a little This Week in Hockey History. So let's kind of delve into this to wrap up the show. I want to ask you about two things. But first of all, February 13th, 1999, Maple Leaf Gardens hosted its final game ever. And I would think, as a young Leafs fan growing up, that must have been the greatest thing for you, would be if you got tickets to a Leafs game. I don't know, they were historically bad there in the 80s, whatever. That must have been so cool. That was the building you got to grow up watching hockey games and probably get a chance to go to a handful of them yourself.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I mean, I grew up in the era where, you know, even back then, it was very, very tough to get tickets to a Leaf game. And so what would happen is the company my dad worked for had season's tickets, and he would get one pair of tickets a year. And it was usually around Christmas time. It would show up in my stocking, and we would get to go to the gardens. And it was just a huge thrill. I mean, I remember taking the subway down. I remember the murals on the subway. I remember going out onto the street and walking down. And sometimes we'd go have dinner at the Golden Griddle across the street. And then you'd go up those skinny escalators. And it was such a phenomenal old building. And it's part of the reason, like, growing up as a hockey fan in that building, I can't get into these new buildings where they all feel the same and they all feel, you know, there's all the ads and everything around. And it makes me feel like a cranky old guy, because these buildings are objectively better fan experiences than the gardens where, I mean, you watch those old highlights of the 1980s Leafs games and something happens and a fan stands up and it blocks the camera. Like, the Hockey Night Canada can't show anymore because Gus in the front row decided to stand up and that just blew their whole plan. But I did. I loved the garden so much, and it was a sad day when it closed, and a sad game too, because it was they got blown out by the Blackhawks that night. I can still remember, and the great trivia question of all the legends who ever played in Maple Leaf Gardens, who scored the last goal in Maple Leaf Gardens history?
Was it Bob Probert?
It was Bob Probert.
Yeah, I thought so.
And the other thing that I do remember, and I think this was something that was done on purpose, but do you remember who took the faceoff for the Blackhawks that night? The last opening night faceoff in Maple Leaf Gardens history, the Blackhawks sent out Doug Gilmour, who was doing his, you know, that was back when he was playing 2 weeks for every team in the entire league, and he happened to be on the Hawks. And so
guys dropped the puck. I got to be in Buffalo.
exactly.
Or maybe it's Jersey. I don't know. I'm going somewhere. Hey, do you know who scored the last goal? You'll love this. You know who scored the last goal at the Forum in Montreal?
No, I don't.
This is better than Probert. Because you think about the storied history of the Montreal Forum, I believe it was Andrei Kovalenko.
Oh my.
So I think that trumps that one. All right. But the one I wanted to finish up with this week in hockey history, February the 10th, 1993. Sean, the Calgary Flames absolutely waxed the San Jose Sharks 13-1. As you look at the box score, the one thing that jumps out at you, Theo Fleury was a +9 in a single game. Theo Fleury +9.
That was okay. So, I mean, first of all, clearly that Sharks team was all time bad. That was the Sharks' second year, but those first 2 years, they were so terrible. And I mean, just before you even get to Fleury, just the score 13-1. Can you imagine a 13-1 game today? What would happen?
Sean, I cover the Senators.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe we might be prepping you for the inevitable. But I mean, if a team loses 7-2 these days, it's like we have to have a commission and some soul searching and figure out what happened. 13-1. And back then we were like, yeah, that sounds like a Sharks game, all right, because it was they didn't even take the foot off the gas. But six of those goals came in the third period. Doug Wilson, of all people, is a -7 on that game. So that's you want to talk about having a rough one. And Theo Fleury, yeah, +9, all-time NHL record for a forward. That's the highest plus minus for a single game by a forward in NHL history. One off the all-time record, which is held by Tom Bladen, of all people, who I wouldn't be surprised if many people listening to this don't even know who that is. Is a defenseman in the 70s. Had a +10 one night against the Cleveland Barons, to give you a sense of how lopsided that one was for the Flyers. I don't want to ever say that there's such thing as an unbreakable record. I'm pretty sure we're never going to see another forward go +9 in a single game ever again.
Yeah, you know, for a little context, too, I looked it up. So since the year 2000, if you're wondering, like, what's the highest plus minus for a player in this century? It's a combination. Sergei Gonchar and Ken Klee were both +7 for the Washington Capitals in a beatdown of the Panthers in 2003. But they were +7.
I would not have Ken Klee. Boy, we could have named players for a long time before I would have got to Ken.
Ken Klee.
Ken Klee. And by the way, speaking of players that you wouldn't expect holding a record, the other thing from that Sharks game, 13-1 game, is it also established the all-time record for most points by a goaltender in a game. 3 assists that night for Calgary Flames goaltender, of all people, when you think of all the great puck-handling goalies and offensive good, Ron Hextall.
Is this Trefilov?
Jeff Reese.
Oh, Jeff Reese. Is the
only goaltender to ever have 3 assists in a game. That night against San Jose is the all-time single-game scoring leader among goaltenders. I that is not a guy. And I don't even know if any of those came off passes. It may have just been the rare San Jose Shark shot. You make a save, we pass it up. Theo Fleury gets a breakaway, and it's a point on the board for the goaltender. But yeah, that's one of my favorite records of all the great offensive-minded goaltenders that we've seen. Jeff Reese is the only guy to ever get the 3 points on a night.
See, always comes back to ex-Leafs. Jeff Reese, Ken Klee. Yep.
So you see, Flames fans, really, the Gilmore trade, you really won the trade because you got the record breaker out of it.
I want to ask you to conclude this show. Theo Fleury is the single game record holder for 2 remarkable records, one being +9. The other is he's the only forward, I believe, Sean, to get a shorthanded hat trick in a game. What is the more unbreakable record? Or maybe a better way to phrase it is, if you could see one of those things happening, would it be a player getting a shorthanded hattie or a +9? Because I'm really torn on this one. I think it's the shorthanded goals because we see them, but I don't know that we're ever going to see another guy get a shorthanded hat trick.
Yeah, it would certainly be, if you're talking about a record being broken, so somebody would need 4 shorthanded goals, that would be almost impossible. I could see it. Even especially if it got to a game, how it could happen is these days with goalies being pulled early, if you're already killing a penalty and the other team pulls the goalie and you throw one down the ice, and, that still counts as a shorthanded goal. Maybe you could see it that way. The plus nine, I just can't see, because I mean, you're looking at a situation where it would have to be a huge blowout. And these days teams shut it down when they've got a lead like that, right? You're good, but you staple them to the bench. You don't want to make the other team feel bad. You can't hurt anyone's feelings in this league. So, I think if I had to bet on seeing one of those records matched in my lifetime, it would be the shorthanded goals. But that's a tough one, because it's very rare to see anyone get two in a game, let alone to finish off the hat trick that way.
Yeah, I don't know that Theo Fleury gets enough credit for holding those two records. So, it's quite the feather in his cap. All right, we'll leave it there, Sean. This was fun, as always. Enjoy what should be a pretty interesting and compelling Saturday night hockey game between the Habs and the Maple Leafs. And, as I look ahead to the schedule, I see we got the Leafs and the Senators next week. So I can only imagine how much fun that'll be for us. Coming up.
And I look forward to a Leaf going plus 10 with four shorthanded goals in that game. And
13-1.
We could be wrong on that one. Yeah.
Yeah, we set it all up. But hey, listen, enjoy the weekend. We'll get you again next Thursday.
Right on. Talk to you then.
All right. And so for Sean, I'm Ian Mettis saying thanks so much for listening to us. A reminder, you can always email us, hit us up at theathletichockeyshow@gmail.com. We do want to remind you, as I mentioned off the top, great interview with Jason Spezza on the Athletic Hockey Podcast, Two Man Advantage, Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun. Check that out as well. And I'll be back on Monday with Haley Salvian to wrap up the weekend that was. And if you are not a subscriber to The Athletic, join us at theathletic.com/hockeyshow.